This is Mark Strassman, reporter with Utopia Media Medical News Network. We're about to talk with Jason Cato, who's a reporter at the Herald in Rock Hill, South Carolina. Welcome to Utopia Media Medical News Network.
Thank you.
We're talking to you because you've been covering, on behalf of Herald, a case involving Christopher Pittman. Why don't you tell us very briefly what his case involves? What's he charged with, and what's his defense?
Okay, Christopher Pittman was arrested and charged on November 29, 2001, with the double murder of his grandparents in Chester County, South Carolina, which is in our coverage area, just south of here. I guess the details of the case were that he had shot each of his grandparents in their respective heads while they were sleeping, and then burned the house down and took a family car and was found some 50, 60 miles away later that same day. He was 12 years old at the time, and his defense is going to be that it was an adverse reaction to his antidepressant medication that caused him to his violent behavior.
And what kind of antidepressant medication had he been on, and for how long, and was he on more than one, and what's the story with that?
At the time that his grandparents were killed, he was on Zoloft. He'd been on Zoloft for maybe 2.5 weeks.
Okay.
Prior to that, he'd been on Paxil for about a week and a half.
Right. And who would put him on these drugs?
A psychiatrist in Florida, where he was from, where his father, he lived with his father and his sister, put him on Paxil, and then he came to live with his grandparents about a week and a half later.
So he wasn't under the direct supervision of the psychiatrist who had put him on it when he committed the crime, or allegedly committed the crime?
No. When he'd come to Chester, a general practitioner, a family doctor there, that the grandmother knew through her work, she was a volunteer at the local hospital, switched him to Zoloft.
Okay. Oh, okay. So the doctor in Florida had put him on Paxil, and the doctor in South Carolina put him on Zoloft.
Correct.
Okay. So he was under his supervision.
Correct.
At the time. This is a case that involves more than just Christopher Pittman, apparently. What? Give us, if you can, a sort of brief rundown and summary of the activities that have been going on in the court after he was charged and made this defense, especially involving, if you could start with the judge, who apparently had to recuse himself.
Correct. He's following this whole story through, and it started out in the family court. He had a psychiatric evaluation done there by the state. Then later there was another hearing to have him waived up to criminal court just for the seriousness of the crimes and the solicitor's, I guess, feelings that Pittman could not be rehabilitated. Family court judge agreed with him and sent him up to criminal court. The judge who was over that case there was over it for about a year.
What was his name?
I'm sorry?
What was that judge's name?
Paul Short.
Okay.
And when the defense made a move to get to confidential documents from Pfizer pertaining to Zoloft that they've seen in other civil cases, that there put Pfizer into the legal battle.
Right.
And the judge later discovered that evening, from what he put in his motion to recuse himself, that he discovered that his wife owned stock in Pfizer.
His wife is just not a plain housewife either, is she?
No, his wife's a state senator.
And what you told me a little earlier, she followed in the footsteps of her husband when he left the state senate and went to the bench.
Correct.
And then she became the state senator, which presumably she still is?
Yes, she is.
Okay. What's her name?
Her name is Linda Short.
Okay, and she turned out to own stock in Pfizer.
Correct. Not a lot of shares. If I remember correctly, it was 80-something shares of
right.
Pfizer.
Okay.
But just, with the appearance of that, he made the decision. He'd already been selected to move up to the appeals court.
Oh.
He was already in that process and wanted to just stay on just
okay.
to finish this case. But once that came up, I think he just decided that he'd probably just, rather do this now, which, the defense lawyers, praise as being the right thing to do.
Right. So there was no hardship for him on recusing himself and going on to the appeals court?
No.
Okay. So that Judge Short then recused himself. What happened then how'd they get a new judge?
The state Supreme Court appointed a judge out of Charleston.
Okay. What's his name?
Daniel Piper.
Okay. Is he still presiding over the case then?
He is. He just was appointed maybe 6 weeks ago.
Okay. So did he, it take him a while to get up to speed on all the technical and medical issues?
I imagine it has. There, he's had no hearings or any such thing like that to where the media would have access to him or he would have any formal part in this process yet, other than behind the scenes getting information, trying to get up to speed. But we expect that later this week he'll announce the date of the next hearing in this case, which I'm told could be as early as next week or perhaps the first week in August.
Okay, and the purpose of that hearing would be to determine what?
I guess it's two different things. One, the defense has filed a motion to try to get the case remanded back to family court, to where if Pittman were found guilty, he would only be held in state custody at the longest until he was 21 years old.
Right. How old is he now?
He's 15.
And so that's been 3 years since the crime was committed.
Nearly. It'll be 15 this November.
Right.
It'll be 3 years this November.
Right. Is that unusually long in a case like this? Or, I mean, maybe there aren't cases like this, but is that unusual in any case?
In a lot of places, yes, it is. In the county where this occurred, it's, you know, one of the more economically depressed counties in our state.
Right.
And just a lot of people use, you know, the public defender's office, the solicitor, you know, has a lot of things.
Solicitor, the term you use there for prosecutor?
Correct.
Okay.
Their backlog is a little bit bigger than okay. most, but a lot of the unique things that have happened in this case, including bringing on new attorneys and the judge accusing himself, I mean, all of that has added some time onto this.
Okay. So there's the factor of the court is not overly funded in order to expedite things, and at the same time there have been some complications that aren't usually there, so those both have delayed the resolution of the case.
Certainly.
What's been your involvement in the case so far? Did you pick this case? Were you assigned by your editor? What have you been doing to cover it? Who have you been talking to?
My involvement in this case started from day one. I came into work that day and was told that there were two bodies found in a house fire in Chester County, and so that's where
okay.
I got started. And you know, that afternoon, talked to the sheriff and found out that the grandson had admitted to it, and from there it just kind of took off.
Okay.
I think as soon as the story first hit you know, the wires, when it went out, some people started contacting me just inquiring to see if he had happened to be on any antidepressant medication. I can't remember whether I mentioned that in the first story or not.
Right. You mean even though you may not have mentioned it, you were getting calls from outside South Carolina, people asking you whether he had been on antidepressants.
Yeah, people that just see cases like this that seem, I mean, just kind of bizarre, to, you know, put it mildly, just to check to see if,
right.
you know, if that were a factor or not. So
what
about
you,
a week and a half later, I'd done a story and I'd talked to an advocacy group. I talked to Dr. Peter Bragan, who actually now turns out to be, 2 years later, he'll be the psychopharmacology expert for the defense.
Have you gotten pretty immersed in the psychopharmacology of antidepressant medication?
Without a doubt. I mean, with this case, it's been hard not to, especially with all the things that have happened and continue to happen involving that issue, from the FDA to, you know, the British equivalent, the MHRA, you know, bans and restrictions put on these drugs, different various reports, the FDA hearings, what was supposed to today have been, you know, beginning of congressional hearings.
Right. So, if I could be a little flip about it, this case is sort of becoming the poster child for bad behavior on antidepressants. Potentially.
In a way, I guess. I mean, I don't know. I guess it just depends on, you know, which side of the issue you're on. I mean, I'm sure that the drug companies would love to see it that way, but I'm also sure that, you know, a lot of people who have experienced this or, you know, are victims of it themselves wouldn't quite see it in that light.
In other words, people can have feelings based on that are exacerbated by these drugs, but they don't go out and kill their grandparents. In other words, what you're saying?
That's what many, many people say, yes. And I would have to believe that if it is true that you know, these drugs do, you know, cause adverse reactions in certain patients that take them, then, you know, the vast majority of the people who experience these things, I would think, aren't going out and killing other people. Or
right. Well, if they did,
there'd be
a lot fewer. if the tens of millions of people who are on antidepressants went out and all killed somebody, it would be a pretty
right.
big story.
Right. You know, and obviously, you know, it's even, you know, even those that do argue that, you know, there are severe side effects you know, that can be caused in certain people with these drugs. It's, you know, they at the same time they say it's not everyone. You know, I mean, there
right.
are people who are helped, but you know, I think that their concern is for those who aren't helped by these and are actually their conditions are made worse. You know, the doctors and patients and parents and just the public in general needs to know about that.
Speaking to the general public, what in your reporting or otherwise have you found about the mood in South Carolina? How do people view this? Do they blame him? Do they blame the drug companies? Do they blame the psychiatrist? Do they blame modern times? What's the what's generally been the public reaction to the issues in this case?
From the very first story that I ever wrote, and that was in December 2001, just, you know, about the potential that his antidepressants could have played a role in this, the reactions were pretty flippant. I mean, it was, you know, it's just an excuse. You know, it's just a convenient thing to say,
right.
you know, to get out of doing something. But I think, you know, the more as things have evolved, you know, not only my own stories, but obviously national and international stories. I mean, from you know, the biggest news organizations in the world, I think it's started to play on people's minds a little bit more that maybe there is a lot more to this than we thought or knew or ever imagined.
I'm thinking, I don't know whether whether this is comparable at all, but when one of the members of the Board of Supervisors in San Francisco shot the mayor and Harvey Milk, his defense attorney used what at the time was somewhat flippantly referred to as the Twinkie defense.
That's right.
Because he said he was so hepped up on the sugar that he didn't know what he was doing.
Right.
And in fact, it more or less worked. It reduced either his the crime he was convicted of or the sentence or both. Not that it worked out very well for him in the end anyway, but in any case, if the effects of sugar on the psyche of an accused murderer can get some kind of leniency, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors are a lot more powerful than sugar, it seems to me, in affecting the mental condition of a person who's taking them.
One would think. I mean, I'm also not a psychiatrist
right.
or a scientist, but you know, they're designed to react with the brain.
Right.
I mean, you know, and what they're designed to do is noble and you know, in the right place. I guess, you know, the big question now is, do they really work that way?
Okay. Now, to find out about how they really work this way, I think we've said. Can you say anything before we move on to this part about Christopher Pittman himself and what you have found out about him? Although apparently, as you told me, you've never interviewed him.
No.
Presumably, no one else has he been interviewed by anyone?
No.
Okay. Does he come to court in these events, or does
he does?
Okay.
He does. I mean, he's, you know, from the very first hearing when we first saw him. I mean, he was a 12-year-old kid,
right?
You know, a very, you know, I wouldn't say smallish, but you know, maybe weighed 75-80 pounds,
right?
Very lean. Now, 3 years later, I mean, he's hit puberty. He's probably a foot taller. I mean, just as lean as. Some little facial hair now. I mean, he's growing up.
What facility has he been held in, or what facilities has he been held in?
He's being held and has been held since all of this happened in the Department of Juvenile Justice Detention Center, Pretrial Detention Center in Columbia, South Carolina.
Okay. So from what you've been able to gather, though, was he a kind of murderous kid before he started taking drugs?
No. Not from what I've been able to gather. I mean, this was, you know, completely out of character. Just... His grandparents had helped raise him for most of his life in Florida.
And he had a good relationship with... Was it the same grandparents that he's allegedly killed? Or
correct, yes.
And he had a good relationship... He had a well-known, good relationship with them.
They were as much parents to him as his father was.
Okay.
And for a number of years, they all lived together at grandparents' house. And about 4 years... In 97, so about 4 years before these killings, the grandparents had retired... Grandfather was from up here and it had always come to the family, and they'd bought 20 acres and built their retirement home here. And Christopher was unhappy in Florida for whatever reasons and was actually trying to run away to get to Chester when he got put on the Paxil in the first place.
Ah.
So he was trying to get to his grandparents to live with them.
Why was he put on Paxil in the first place?
From what I've been told and just the few medical records I've seen from my facility, it was just that he was diagnosed as having minimal to mild depression.
And one of the symptoms, if you can call it that, of the depression was that he was trying to run away to get to be with his grandparents.
Exactly.
Who he later killed after they gave him the medication, in part prompted by his efforts to get to his grandparents. It's a little ironic, it seems to me. Let's talk about the drug companies and their role in all this. Have they just been sitting idly by saying, we'll be glad to help you with any information we can possibly provide about these drugs and their effect on young people, or not?
Not really.
Okay.
You know, the conversations I've had with them, I mean, I guess the biggest thing with this is that, you know, they always say, well, in dealing particularly with Paxil and Prozac makers, GlaxoSmithKline and Pfizer.
Right, let's assign credit where credit is. Okay. Pfizer makes
Pfizer is Zoloft, GlaxoSmithKline makes Paxil.
Okay.
Both are antidepressants, both classified as selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, or
right.
SSRIs.
All right.
Basically, the company line that I've gotten has just been that our drugs are not approved to treat depression in children, so we don't really address that area. Anything in particular to do with this case, especially with Pfizer, they don't discuss any ongoing litigation. So
you haven't really been able to speak to Pfizer at all?
Not other than getting the, you know, the company line from, you know, spokespeople.
And in fact, the company line is that their drug, that Zoloft, is approved by the FDA for use in adults, but it's not
right.
approved for use in children or adolescents.
Right.
And if anything untoward happens when it's given to children or adolescents, that's not their problem? Is that what they're saying?
Yeah, in a lot of ways, I think that's exactly what they're saying.
Now, there's a drug called Neurontin it's an anti-epileptic drug, I think. And a lawsuit to the tune of about $346 million. I think it's made by Pfizer. I think it's made by Pfizer. I have to check the article I wrote myself about it. But they settled a $346 million lawsuit because it was alleged that they were strongly encouraging doctors to prescribe it for off-label uses. Off-label for our listeners is when a drug that's been approved by the FDA for a certain purpose is used for another purpose, which is perfectly legal. It's called off-label prescribing, but the drug companies are not supposed to encourage it. And Pfizer was encouraging it, and things weren't working out too well, and they settled a third of a $1 billion lawsuit on that basis. That's kind of the same point here with Pfizer saying that if adolescents get into trouble. It's an off-label use. It's not something that is of concern to us.
I'm vaguely aware of that, but I mean that all sounds very, very familiar. And even to draw a parallel to the SSRI issue that's going on now, it also sounds similar to what the Attorney General of the State of New York is alleging against GlaxoSmithKline.
Yes.
And Paxil, and that, you know, they had drug reps going out, maybe making assertions that weren't true, or certainly making assertions about that drug with children that the company can't say because it doesn't have approval to treat depression in children.
Right, and in fact, you mentioned, I think, before we started recording, about what's been going on in the United Kingdom, in the UK, on this front with the equivalent there of the FDA. Tell us what they've decided to do in the UK in this regard.
Well, in December of this past year, the British equivalent, the UK equivalent of the FDA, basically all but banned SSRIs from being used with children. I mean, they're not at all banned, but what they've said is make them your very last line of defense. Try everything else possible.
What's that group called in the UK?
That's the the Medicines Health Regulatory Agency.
Okay.
MHRA.
Right.
The only one that isn't affected by what they've done is Prozac.
Right.
And that's the only SSRI antidepressant that's been approved by the FDA to treat depression in children.
Okay, so it's been approved by the American FDA, the U.S. FDA to
right.
use in children, and it's allowed by the British equivalent of the FDA to be used in children?
Correct.
But all the other SSRIs are, as you said, effectively banned from use in children and
right.
adolescents.
I think they call it contratained, which, you know, means all but banned.
Okay. With all of this, you'd think then that the defense attorneys for Christopher Pittman would make the deleterious effects of Zoloft and Paxil on children the centerpiece of their defense. That's what they're doing, right?
Without a doubt.
They're not arguing that he didn't do it.
No, I don't.
They're arguing that he did it because of the effects of these drugs.
Correct.
Okay, now, have they called any experts in these SSRIs to help them in their defense?
Certainly.
Who have they been getting?
I think one of the biggest things that has, you know, come online for Christopher Pittman in his defense are the expert attorneys that he now has helping him out, as well as then, you know, expert scientists that they've retained to help in his defense. The psychopharmacology expert that they have, the main person for the defense is Dr. Peter Bragan from Ithaca, New York.
Okay.
And I know that they've talked to a couple others who may or may not ever be involved in the case or not. So I really would rather not mention their names at this point.
Sure.
But, I mean, they do have others that they're talking to that they could bring on. As well as I talked to a number of experts and scientists around the country and world who, you know, follow this case. You know, they want to know more about it all the time.
Okay, you know, in terms of other attorneys, I've interviewed Karen Barth Menzies from Baum Hedlund here in Los Angeles a few times. What's her relationship to the case now? And she, of course, for people who haven't listened to the other interviews, is the lead attorney in the big Paxil suit against GlaxoSmithKline for causing addiction in thousands of people who took the drug.
Correct.
And withdrawal when they try to stop. She's a civil attorney, and she's arguing the civil case against GlaxoSmithKline. What's her role in this criminal case?
She's come on board in this case pro bono, as has Andy Vickery, an attorney, mainly civil attorney from Houston, Texas, who won the federal suit in Wyoming a few years ago against Paxil, where a jury there found that the drug was to blame for 80% of a triple murder suicide, and awarded the family, I believe they ended up in the end getting a little over $6 million in the settlement. It was a civil suit. But they both come on pro bono in this case, and, you know, in a lot of ways to lend their expertise to Christopher Pittman in his defense.
So, in effect, he's got the best defense money can buy, and he doesn't have to pay for it.
That's right.
Okay. And so what efforts has the defense made to get discovery or other processes to get some of the information that they have found in their civil litigation to exist in the vaults of GlaxoSmithKline and Pfizer that they think will be useful in this case that aren't part of the criminal case yet? How is that effort going?
Well, that effort started and stopped fairly quickly when the previous judge recused himself. I mean, that was the first day that this was ever argued in court. I mean, they had, you know, filed their motions maybe a week or so before,
right,
to seek discovery on these certain documents that they know exist and have seen in other cases,
right,
that they've told me will undoubtedly help them prove their case.
And in fact, it was the filing of those discovery motions and the judge's need to rule on them that led to the discovery of his wife's stock ownership in Pfizer and his decision to recuse himself.
Correct.
Okay. And then there was a certain delay until a new judge was appointed.
That's right.
So have those discovery motions been refiled now in front of the new judge?
They wouldn't need to be refiled. I mean, they're still pending.
Okay.
And we expect that there should be a hearing in the next, you know, 2 to 3 weeks.
Okay. Now, are the issues there scientific, legal, or political in terms of the judge's decision upcoming to decide about whether to ask Pfizer and GlaxoSmithKline to provide this information?
Are you asking me what influences I think will be on the judge to make his decision?
Right.
I anticipate they'll be purely legal.
Oh, okay. And on that, what do you know about the case law or the arguments, or whether this is settled law that if someone applies discovery to find out more about allegedly detrimental substances, whether those are usually acceded to or not?
That I'm not sure. I mean, that is completely out of my hands and out of my area of expertise.
Have those arguments been made before the new judge yet?
No, not at all. No arguments have been made before the new judge. And they just started making them before the previous judge.
Ah, okay.
That day when he recused himself, actually that evening.
Okay, so focus a little bit on the schedule then. The next hearing that's coming up will be when and for the purpose of arguing what? Or discussing
what? It'll probably be announced either Thursday or Friday. From what I've been told, the prosecutor has been on vacation for the last couple of weeks, and that's when he's back in the office. So
okay.
I was told that no decision will be made before then.
Right.
But I anticipate that Thursday or Friday there'll be some hearing scheduled, which, from what I've been told, if they don't fall the last week of July, probably will be the first week of August.
Okay. Now, how does the prosecutor feel about this? Has the prosecutor thought that in the interest of truth, more information ought to be there, or in the interest of winning his case, less information ought to be there?
Just knowing him from...
What's his name?
His name is John Justice.
John Justice?
That's right.
Well, that's a good name for a prosecutor. What can I say?
Okay. It certainly is.
All right.
He just staunchly believes that this is, he's trying a murder case.
Right.
He's not trying a, you know, product liability, whatever. I mean, it's strictly black and white for him.
Okay.
I mean, these crimes are committed, and the person that committed them needs to be punished.
Right.
And
okay.
He needs to protect society.
Now, has he gotten any help, either publicly or non-publicly, from Pfizer or GlaxoSmithKline to help him prosecute the case? As far as you know?
I don't think he would ever describe it in terms of helping him prosecute the case.
Right.
You know, what he said to me and what he said in open court is just that, you know, he and other members of the prosecution team, such as some of their scientists and experts and things, have been provided some materials, mostly for him, just kind of background materials to help him even understand, you know, what psychopharmacology is and what is going on with SSRIs.
Right. It's been alleged that what he's gotten is our handbooks from Pfizer and GlaxoSmithKline that distill all the information that they've put together about how to defend against cases just like this, where a criminal defendant is claiming some of the problems are that his actions were precipitated by the use of their drugs.
Right, and you're talking about in particular the prosecutor's manual.
Right.
And from what I've been told, I've never seen one from either company.
Right.
He has said that he has one from GlaxoSmithKline for Paxil.
He's admitted in open court, or to you, or both? Or
both.
That he has a so-called prosecutor's manual from GlaxoSmithKline.
Right. He said he hasn't read it, but he does have it in his possession. Neither of those obviously have ever been made, you know, public record in any way through any other litigation. But
has either GlaxoSmithKline or Pfizer admitted to the existence of these documents?
Not to me.
Not to you. And presumably, if they haven't admitted to the existence, they are not willing to turn them over to you or anybody else.
I would presume not.
Would discovery to have them made public likely be part of the defense's ongoing case, in addition to the other information they want to get about the test results and similar data from the drug companies?
I imagine it is, and I'm fairly certain that the Zoloft prosecutor's manual has specifically been requested and part of what they're looking for.
So it's on their list. They've asked for it.
Yes, and from what I'm told, some of the defense attorneys already have copies of these manuals from other cases that they've worked on. They're just not public. They've been sealed by the courts.
Right. There's obviously a lot of that. Say something about the relationship between the information that Karen Barth Menzies has as a litigator in a civil suit about information from these drug companies and the difficulty in getting that information entered into this criminal trial.
If you just go by, you know, how difficult it's been in other trials, and I don't know how many times it's been tried, that defense attorneys have tried to go after this information, and particularly in criminal cases, but it's never been admitted before, or it would be out there. The thing with the civil cases is I think that a lot of these documents have come in for those and discovery on those, but, you know, once those cases are settled, then, you know, so seems to be the availability to having getting your hands on those documents. It's settled. They're sealed. You can't see them.
Right. In fact, an important term in all of the settlements is the continuing secrecy of the documents.
Exactly.
Okay. All right. I think we've gotten a pretty good picture of what's going on here. This is obviously extremely important to the drug companies that this information not come out and that this defense not be made, isn't it?
If the information, you know, does exist and it is what, you know, a lot of people allege it is, then that seems to be the case. They don't want it to come out.
Right.
Other of it, they say that the information doesn't exist, and then even still, and all of it, you know, is proprietary.
All right. So
trade secrets.
Right. Trade secrets. So, I don't don't get too far afield. The same reason voting companies give for not giving out the code for their voting machines is trade secrets. They don't want it to be publicly known.
Right.
As a reporter who's covered this in depth from the beginning, do you think that this information exists? And as you notice, I've kept from asking you to make any kind of value judgment about anything involved here, which I'll continue to do. But maybe you could say something about how intense the feelings have been that you've observed from the drug companies in their reluctance to let any of this out, and, you know, without the common sense thought about that would obviously be, if they've got nothing to hide, why don't they let this information out?
Sure, and you hear that argument a lot. I mean, I think that, you know, from what I've seen from them, you know, in the numerous times that I've been able to talk with somebody or a spokesperson or whoever from either of these companies, I mean, it's been very professional but very kind of, you know, corporate stoic in a way, you know.
Right.
I mean, they...
Do you know anything?
They have their position, and, you know, they're not going to budge off of it for me, you know, certainly.
Right. Do you know anything about whether they're working together
to
make a united front here, big competitors that they are?
I've never heard anything, you know, to indicate that they are.
Okay. So, in addition to not making judgments, I'm not going to ask you to make predictions either, but... except beyond what's really known. Just sort of summarize for us where things stand now and what's going to happen next.
Well, I think where things stand now, say as opposed to 6 or 8 months ago, I mean, now that Christopher Pittman has Andy Vickery and Karen Menzies helping defend him, I know that the outlook of his family, and from what I've told even of him, you know, is very much more positive. They just like the things they hear, and they like the expertise they have on their sides. Where it's going to go from here, it's going to be a huge battle. I mean, first, it's going to be a huge battle on pretrial hearings, trying to get to these documents they say exist, the drug companies have in their possession. After that, you know, whether they get them or not, when it goes to court, I think it's going to be a big uphill battle. I mean, this is a very complicated issue, and a lot of people are watching this, but... You know, in Chester County, they're going to have to pick 12 jurors and then take whatever time they need, whether it be a week or two or a month, whatever it might be, to convince those 12 people that reasonable doubt does exist.
Presumably, there's going to be a big job educating. If John Justice had to go talking to Pfizer and GlaxoSmithKline to learn about SSRIs, you can imagine the 12 jurors and how what the efforts are going to have to be to bring them up to speed on the... psychopharmacological aspects of the case.
Certainly, and that's not going to be an easy task for sure.
All right.
I mean, I guess the one thing that the defense team has going for it is they don't have to prove their point 100% beyond a doubt. They just have to, you know, maybe convince the jury enough that this did play a role. And I guess that's the task that they're charged with.
Have people been out there doing more survey research than usual in the county to find out what people's attitudes are towards personal responsibility versus drug-induced bad behavior?
Not that I'm aware of. I would highly doubt it if they had.
And there really hasn't been a case like this really anywhere, and certainly not in South Carolina in the past.
Certainly not South Carolina, and from what I'm aware of, nationwide, not really, not a criminal case of this nature. I mean, typically what you see in cases like this, I mean, a lot of it does have to do against family members, and a lot of it, you know, has to do with strangers, but, you know, this is one of the more serious and tragic cases that I've heard of.
I regret I don't know the exact details, but I've seen a few places where it said that the Columbine shooters were on SSRIs, both of them at the time they committed their crime in Colorado.
Yeah, I've heard that as well. Certainly for one of them, but I believe I've heard it for both of them as well.
Yeah, right. So there are some simple precedents along these lines, assuming that you don't think they were just bad kids in Columbine, just bad kids who decided to, you know, act out.
Right.
Have all of the last question here? Have all of the satellite trucks surrounded the courthouse yet, or am I pretty much one of the few people who's tried to get this in-depth on this story so far, or both?
You're one of the few that, at least with me, has tried to get this in-depth on the story, but I have talked to a number of reporters, television, print, from around the country who, you know, are keeping an eye on this And whenever the trial date is set, all plan to be here.
Okay. So people want the honest information, the direct information, the complete information. They can talk. They can listen to you talking on Utopia Media Medical News Network. I'm very thankful for your talking to us today, and hopefully we'll be able to keep in touch and keep people up to date on what's happening in this very interesting and probably landmark case.
Well, I hope so.
Okay. Well, thanks very much for your help again.
All right. Take care.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.